Hello and welcome to today's press call. There will be prepared remarks and a Q&A to follow. To ask a question after the prepared remarks conclude, please press star one. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Emily Kane, who will kick this off.
Thank you and hi everyone. Thank you for joining us to announce the sixth edition of our Community Standards Enforcement Report. You should have received a copy of the report and the accompanying newsroom post via email ahead of this call. Today, you will hear opening remarks from Vice President of Integrity, Guy Rosen, and Vice President of Content Policy, Monica Bickert. We will then open up the call for questions. There is no embargo for this call, and it is on the record. With that, I'll go ahead and kick it over to Guy. Guy?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So today, we're releasing our sixth Community Standards Enforcement Report, covering how we're doing at finding and removing harmful content from April through June. For the past couple of years, we have done these once a half, and now we are moving to quarterly, just like our earnings report. I'd like to walk you all through some of the highlights. To start, COVID-19 continues to have an impact on our content enforcement. To protect the health and safety of our workforce in March, we sent all our content reviewers home. We then operated on two parallel paths, one, enabling our reviewers to work from home as much as possible, and two, relying more heavily on our technology to review content. We've expedited some work, which was already underway, to reorganize our content enforcement system. We're now using artificial intelligence to create a ranking of the most critical content for our teams to review, regardless of whether it was reported by users or detected by our proactive systems. This enables our teams to spend their time on the cases where we need their expertise the most, and it means there will be a shift towards more content being initially actioned by our automated systems. Today's report gives us a fuller picture of the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on content review. It shows that we do have the tools and processes to respond to emerging issues and to continue finding and removing content that violates our policies. But it also reinforces that content enforcement is not an either-or approach where we use either human reviewers or AI. Sophisticated systems need both people and technology. Let's take, for example, suicide and self-injury and child nudity and sexual exploitation content. These are two areas where we rely on people to both review content as well as to constantly help improve the technology that proactively finds and removes even more. Now, with fewer reviewers, we took action on fewer pieces of content on both Facebook and Instagram for suicide and self-injury, and on Instagram for child nudity and sexual exploitation. Despite this decrease, we prioritized and we took action on the content that is the most harmful, such as live videos. But reviewing this content continues to be challenging. It can't be done from home due to its very graphic nature. We want to ensure it's reviewed in a more controlled environment, and that's why we started bringing a small number of reviewers, where it's safe, back into the office. The number of appeals is also lower in this report because we couldn't always offer them. We still gave people an option to tell us that they disagreed with our decision on a piece of content, and our teams looked at these signals in aggregate to find potential issues and restored content where appropriate. You can see that in the report counted as content restored without an appeal. Now, lastly, because we prioritized removing harmful content over measurement of certain efforts, we were unable to calculate the prevalence in a few areas, in violent and graphic content and adult nudity and sexual activity. We anticipate that the metrics from Q3 will be available in our next report. Now, despite the challenges due to the pandemic, in some areas, we have made improvements to our technology that's enabled us to take action on more content. For example, in hate speech, the amount of content we took action on increased from 9.6 million in Q1 to 22.5 million in Q2. Of that, 95% was detected proactively before anyone reported it to us, up from 89% in Q1 and 24% when we first started publishing these reports. In Q1, we made improvements to our proactive detection technology and expanded automation in Spanish, Arabic, and Indonesian. In Q2, we followed up by expanding with more automation in English and Spanish and in Burmese. On Instagram, we took action on 3.3 million pieces of content in Q2 for hate speech, 84% of which was detected proactively, and that's up from 45% in Q1. Additionally, the amount of terrorism content we took action on increased from 6.3 million in Q1 to 8.7 million in Q2. We've made progress in combating hate on our apps, but this work is never done. And as Mark said on our earnings call the other week, we don't benefit from hate. We don't want it on our platforms, and fighting it requires a combination of enforcement and policies. Monica will speak to this more. In the past months, we've prioritized work around harmful content related to COVID-19 that could put people at risk. As some misinformation poses imminent harm, we remove it. So from April through June, we removed over 7 million pieces of harmful COVID-19 misinformation from Facebook and Instagram. This is things such as posts that push fake preventative measures or exaggerated cures that the CDC and other health experts tell us are dangerous. For other misinformation, we work with independent fact checkers to display warning labels. From April through June, we put these labels on about 98 million pieces of COVID-19 related misinformation on Facebook. We're also very focused on the upcoming US election, and we've spent the past 4 years building up systems and teams to fight misinformation, to stop election interference, and to push out accurate information. We've already broadened our policies to ban more content that would mislead people about voting or try to intimidate them so they don't vote. And from March to July, we removed more than 110,000 pieces of content in the US for violating those policies. We're also building up our election operations center to continue our work with state election authorities that we can quickly respond to and remove false claims about polling conditions in the 72 hours leading into election day. Earlier today, we also introduced new ratings and updated labels for our fact-checking program. We've heard from fact-checkers that more clarity and distinction between ratings is important and better reflects what they're seeing on the platform. As Mark also announced in June, we're going to use our Election Operations Center, which I just mentioned, we're going to be rolling out our Voting Information Center soon. It'll be a one-stop shop for people to find accurate, authoritative information about the elections. Now, finally, back to this report. We know people want to be confident that the numbers in this report are accurate, so we're planning to undergo an independent third-party audit of our content moderation systems to validate the numbers that we publish. Now, this week, we are issuing a request for proposal to external auditors, and we hope to conduct this audit in 2021. Now, I'd like to turn it over to Monica with more detail on the people and the policies that back our enforcement numbers.
Thanks, Guy, and hello, everybody. Guy made reference to the progress that we're making on identifying and quickly removing hate from our services. And these numbers are important because they help people track our progress over time and they serve as a metric of accountability. But it's equally important to understand the people and the policies and the product work that goes on behind those numbers. First, the people. There have been questions recently about the diversity and the makeup of the teams that write our content policies and weigh in on the content decisions. I lead the team that writes our policies. It's made up of about 200 people based in 11 offices around the world. And that team includes experts in everything from child safety to cybersecurity to hate organizations. And this team also has a diverse range of backgrounds, experiences, and political views. Beyond that, we work regularly with hundreds of organizations and experts around the world who help us understand diverse perspectives in crafting our policies. This is a regular part of what we do and has been for years. We're always looking to broaden the input that we receive. And so in that spirit, we are setting up a diversity action council that will include a cross-section of employees from our company to provide input based on their lived experiences on a variety of topics that touch policy and product development. Turning to our policies, We continue to refine our policy lines as speech and society evolve. In our fight against all forms of hate, for example, we've consulted with many of our external group partners over the past year to better understand implicit speech that has historically been used to disparage, intimidate, or exclude people based on protected characteristics like race or religion. So that consultation, which included more than 60 outside experts, including social psychologists, historians, folklorists, and groups that represent a diverse range of religious, ethnic, and racial communities, has helped us write rules for the removal of more implicit hate speech, such as content depicting blackface or stereotypes about Jewish people controlling the world. This type of content has always gone against the spirit of our hate speech policies, but it can be really difficult to take concepts, especially those that are commonly expressed in imagery, and define them in a way that allows our content reviewers based around the world to consistently and fairly identify violations. Those challenges will remain, but we are committed to improving our policies wherever we can, and we'll continue to work with experts around the world to get better at doing this. We also continue to explore new ways to combat dangerous organizations like terror and hate groups. So first, we continue to ban these types of groups from having any presence on our services, and we remove content that represents or praises or supports them. As part of implementing that policy, we routinely evaluate groups and individuals, taking into account both their online and their offline behavior. To date, we've identified and banned hundreds of groups around the world. And last year, we took an enforcement strategy that we had successfully used in a different area, which is combating coordinated inauthentic behavior. And we started using that to focus on dangerous organizations who attempt to evade detection or return to our services after we've banned them. Since October of 2019, we've used this tactic 14 times to remove 23 different banned organizations. The first strategic network disruption we conducted last October was against three US-based white supremacist groups, The Right Stuff, Patriot Front, and Identity Dixie. And since then, we've disrupted networks tied to hate groups, including the Northwest Front, the Proud Boys, the KKK, Combat 18, and the Base. The last thing I want to mention is the product work that's happening to ensure that we introduce technology, tools, features, and products that are fair and equitable. We've set up two new teams, at Instagram, the Equity Team, and at Facebook, the Inclusive Product Council, both of which are tasked with making sure we sense check key moments in product development with diverse perspectives, both internal and external to the company. So this could mean something simple, like making sure that the new stickers in our library reflect the diversity of our community. It can also mean addressing more complicated questions, such as how to ensure fairness in our algorithms, which are used to help us understand things like whether content is likely to violate our policies. We're committed to identifying concerns about equity, equality, and civil rights as early as possible so that we can make adjustments and investments where needed and engineer stronger, more impactful products. As we continue to make progress, not just on policy enforcement, but also on the people, policies, and products that back that enforcement, we will communicate openly and often about what we're doing and why, just as we are today, with the CSER and this press call. And with that, I will turn it back over to the moderator for questions.
We will now open the line for questions. To ask a question, press star followed by the number one. Your first question comes from the line of Stephen Overly from Politico. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi, I just wanted to ask on the hate speech numbers where you took action against 22.5 million pieces of content compared to 9.6 last quarter. Is that rise due completely to changes to the technology, or were there other reasons for that number growing so significantly?
Hey, this is Guy. Thanks for the question. The change is largely driven by the increase in proactive detection as driven through the technology that we've been working on.
Sure. Your next question comes from the line of Lawrence Dodds from the Daily Telegraph. Please go ahead.
Hi, folks. Hope you can hear me all right. Thanks very much for the question and for doing this and doing the explanation. I have a question about your policy against images of blackface. In the Netherlands, it seems there's been considerable controversy about how this applies to Zwarte Piet, which has already been a very controversial figure there. I wanted to just check with you, whether the policy would also apply to English traditional Morris dancers who have a similar tradition of effectively using blackface, although they don't call it that, I believe. I'd like to firstly check that it does apply to them and would forbid pictures of them. And then also just, I wonder if you could explain a little about your rationale for sort of including those things within the category of things you ban. From my time sitting in on content standards forums before, I know that sometimes it'll be considered whether there should be a cultural exception for different policies. I would imagine that might be considered in this case and rejected. And I wonder if you could explain more of your rationale and what the process was of deciding against them. Thank you.
Absolutely. So as you know, often when we talk about hate speech, we're focused on more explicit attacks on people based on a protected characteristic. But over the years, and especially through our work with outside experts, we've identified often it's images or it's sort of meme content or generalizations that is more implicitly attacking people. And that over time has led to us actually having a list in our community standards where we say, here are some stereotypes that we remove as hate speech. And so the ones that we're adding now today were arrived at very much in the same process. And you've seen it in the content standards forum. For those who don't know, that's a meeting we have every 2 weeks where we look at potential revisions to our policies and we look at feedback that we've received from groups around the world. And we did that here. In fact, we've worked for the better part of a year in consultation with partners around the world to understand not only how can these stereotypes be used in harmful ways, but also what is the kind of speech, as you point out, what are the kinds of speech that might actually unintentionally be swept into this policy if, depending on how we draw the lines. And so, for instance, when you think about our policy that is prohibiting blackface that we are launching now, that is designed to stop people from using blackface to target or mock black people. But you can imagine somebody sharing an image that shows blackface where they are doing so to say, look at this politician who wore blackface. Everybody should know this. And they're trying to raise awareness. And you can also imagine, that there could be other circumstances where somebody might happen to, be sharing an image with blackface in it, but they're not doing it for a hateful reason. And so those are exactly the sorts of nuances, including the example you raised from the Netherlands and the UK, that we are looking at to understand now and will take into account as we design our implementation standards. We are announcing the policy today. It is not live yet in terms of enforcement.
Your next question comes from the line of Sarah Fryer from Bloomberg. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. My question relates to just a follow-up from the civil rights audit. In that audit, they noted that content reported by users as voter interference is only evaluated and monitored for aggregate trends, so doesn't tend to get looked at by a human moderator. I'm wondering whether you have addressed that concern and are thinking of changing the way you review voter suppression ahead of the election.
Sure. Yeah. So we do actually have clear policies against voter suppression, and we have people that review content that we either detect or get reports about violating those policies. So we do have people look at those and make those determinations. And our voter suppression policies, for instance, ban misrepresentations about how to vote or voting logistics or methods or requirements or whether a vote will be counted or threats of violence related to voting. And in fact, because of the civil rights audit and some of our more sustained engagement with the broader civil rights community, we've actually gone further recently and expanded our policies to also remove content that says that participating in the vote will or could result in law enforcement consequences. So, you know, like you'll be arrested if you show up and or deported if you show up and vote today. And also posts that indicate an intent or encourage others to bring weapons to polling places. So the audit was helpful in helping us see other ways that we can expand those policies, but we do use people when we enforce those.
Your next question comes from the line of Queenie Wong from CNET. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking the time to answer my question. So Guy, you mentioned that Facebook is using AI to create a ranking of the most critical content for the company to review. And then you mentioned in an example that you're prioritizing content that is most harmful, such as live videos. Can you explain in more detail like how this ranking system works? Because like if somebody says, for example, like I want to kill myself, and they put that in a live video versus just putting it in a regular post, that seems like it would have the same amount of potential harm or damage. So is the system like ranking content based on like live video versus photos versus, you know, stories or something? Like how does the whole system work? Because it seems like trying to determine what is more harmful than something else is pretty, it could be difficult.
Hey, thanks for the question. So the way this AI works is it tries to understand and evaluate how severe the content of a certain post might be. Live videos was one example I gave, which is something we've always wanted to make sure we get to very fast. But you're absolutely correct that a post that's a text post that has some sort of imminent, someone is imminently implying they might be taking their lives, is something that we're that would absolutely also be ranked very highly because it's really important for us to get to that. If you step back and sort of think about the way technology helps our content review historically, it helps in proactive detection, so finding things people don't report or finding them sooner. It's helped in automation, which is enabling one decision by a reviewer to be extended to many more pieces of content. And it helps with prioritization, which is increasingly where we've been putting more focus so that the time our reviewers spend is on the content that's the most harmful or content that's being seen by the most people and is really important for us to get to fast.
Your next question comes from the line of Izzy Lepowski from Protocol. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys, and I'm glad I'm following Queenie because my question is related. So, Guy, you had been saying that there was a dip in the amount of self-injury and suicide content and child sexual abuse material content that was taken down in part because of the reduction in human moderators who were available due to COVID. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why that type of content requires more human review, because to the point you just made, you would expect that, you know, most egregious content to be the most proactively action, and you guys obviously took a lot of proactive action on hate speech. So I'm wondering why child sexual abuse material or self-injury would prove more difficult without human beings.
Hey, thanks for the question again. The reason this content is challenging is because it's graphic content that honestly at home is very hard for people to moderate with people around them and so forth. And so we want to be very careful in the people and the environment that people have in order to look at that content. In some of these areas, it is a combination of people and technology working together with people making some of the more nuanced decisions and technology helping to amplify their impact significantly. And so what was really important to us is to make sure that the reduced workforce that is able to work this more difficult type of content is able to focus on the most severe and the most harmful categories within that pool of content that's available to review, and that we're taking action on that content.
Your next question comes from the line of David Uberti from Wall Street Journal.
Hey, all. Thanks for taking the time. I have a similar question just related to this. You've spoken a bit in the past about sort of the push and pull, give and take between AI and human reviewers in the counterterrorism context, and how some of these groups basically try to basically trick the systems or avoid the systems, which requires more human reviewers. I was curious if you could try to flesh that out a little bit for some of these other categories, if there's particular types of areas or particular types of content or user behavior the AI is more adept at picking up over the last few months in particular, or areas where the human reviewers are still key.
I think overall, this pandemic and the situation has really reinforced us that it is always people and technology working together, and you can't let the technology just sort of go entirely on its own. We always need people who also look and measure and help to tune automation to ensure that we're always up to speed and always up to date with sort of how content is evolving and different, be it more adversarial things and the nuances that you mentioned, and an area that where perhaps someone is trying to constantly change how they're expressing things in content, or just keeping up to date with the latest kind of trends and culture and the way people are expressing themselves. Now, this is sort of always a feedback loop. And so the way it works is when reviewers make a decision, that decision is then used by automation to help train and learn and detect more similar or identical pieces of content. And so we need to keep that sort of cycle going, which is why also where we focus our workforce is working on the most harmful kinds of reports, but also making sure that they're focused on measuring and improving the quality of the different kinds of systems so that they can continue to be up to date over time.
Your next question comes from the line of Mike Isaac from the New York Times.
Hi there. Sorry, my question is probably boring, but I'm just trying to figure out. You're talking about how the COVID stuff is impacting how content moderation sort of works and wanting to sort of keep it safe and not have people review things from their homes. So I guess, I'm just wondering what the partnerships with the third-party contractors look like at this point. Are you still the Accentures of the world? Do you still have those going on, but they aren't handling all the content? Or are those sort of closed too? I guess I'm just trying to figure out what that even looks like right now.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, sure.
We continue to work with our partners to help us scale the workforce, especially in many places around the world, many of which are in different sort of phases of the pandemic. And we're working with them literally every day to understand where we can bring some people back into some offices with the right safety precautions, what's the right environment and the right support and well-being support that we can provide their people, whether it's at home or within offices. And we're also working with our own full-time employee workforce, where we have people who are trained on content moderation. They typically help to sort of train and manage that larger workforce, and they have picked up more of that work in the past months to ensure that we are on top of the most severe, the most harmful content.
Your next question comes from the line of Alex Heath from The Information. Please go ahead.
Hey, Monica and Guy. I was wondering, could you elaborate on Facebook's approach it's taking to QAnon, the QAnon movement, especially going into the election? There was a story the other day about how there's a lot of QAnon content on Facebook and classify that movement with regards to content moderation and any kind of more systematic action you might be taking or not taking against QAnon. Thanks.
Sure, I'll take that. We have removed, enforcement against QAnon is not new for us. We've removed pages and groups and other QAnon content where it's violated our policies, and also where their behavior has violated our policies. So as you know, there's times where content might cross the line, and then there's times where the accounts are maybe inauthentic or the way that they are behaving on Facebook violates our policies. So we've taken action against them in April. We did it again in July, and we'll keep looking, at other ways for making sure that we are addressing that content appropriately.
Your next question comes from the line of Mark Sullivan from Fast Company. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm still focusing on this large increase of the number of hate posts that you took action on from Q1 to Q2. You give a couple of different reasons for that. One of them is that you say that you expanded to take action on Spanish, Arabic, and Indonesian or posts in those languages. And you say that it's all also because of English detection technology improvements. But I wonder if you could give an idea of removing those other companies from or those other languages from the equation. Is there a way that you can quantify the increase in the number of actions taken just on English language posts from Q1 to Q2?
Hey. Thanks for the question. We don't have that breakdown here, so we'd have to follow up with you. But generally, it's the increase in proactive and automated systems that is driving this increase across content action for hate speech.
Your next question comes from the line of Raphael Valenieri from Les Echos.
Yes, just picking up on what you said, except, you know, the improvement in languages, isn't it also because globally you saw, you know, more hateful and problematic content on Facebook during COVID because basically everyone was at home, you know, spending time online. And here in France, I mean, many French NGOs actually said there was just much more hate speech on the platforms during that time. So what's your comment on this? And then I had a question on the audit. Who could be the organization that will audit your work on this? And perhaps a final question on China, given the current tensions. Have you seen more disinformation from China on Facebook these days? Thanks.
Hey there. Thanks for those questions. I'll try to remember the three different ones. So again, I mean, the question on the amount of hate speech, the metric we really want to get to is the prevalence of hate speech on Facebook. That's something we are working on, and we plan to have it in our next enforcement report, and it will describe how many, in the same way we have the prevalence metric for a number of other categories, it will describe how many views on Facebook are of content that violates our hate speech policies. Just to reiterate, the increase that we saw and that is reflected in this report, if you sort of do the math in terms of the content that is removed, then it is indeed driven by the increase in automation as a result of our work across a number of different languages and generally to make sure that we're automating and that we're expanding and that amplifying decisions by humans or detecting and sometimes even taking action automatically on different kinds of posts. Your second question on the audit, so we're issuing a request for a proposal to external auditors. There's a number of large reputable firms. We're working with folks like them. And this is a kind of audit that's not been done before on this kind of system. So it's not something that they're accustomed to doing as opposed to, you know, sort of typical financial or, you know, related reporting, which the world sort of knows how to execute. And so we're working with them to explain and to walk through. And obviously we want something that is independent and an independent assessment from a reputable firm that will be able to come in, ask questions and create confidence in the accuracy of the numbers that we are reporting out in this regular report. Now, for your third question, I'll turn over to Monica.
Yes. In terms of disinformation campaigns, that's something that we continue to see globally. And we do, as Guy mentioned earlier, we do have a team now that's really focused on sort of identifying this kind of behavior. That team that's focused on understanding disinformation campaigns and what we call coordinated inauthentic behavior, they work with other companies and they work with researchers and security firms to understand this behavior, get ahead of it, and take it down. And we publish a report every month now where we detail exactly what we've found. So our recent one that we put out did not have anything from China. It did have takedowns from Brazil, the US, Yemen, Ukraine. We have taken down operations from China before. I can remember one that was around this time last year. But if you go back and look at those reports, you'll see that this is very much something that we focus on globally.
Your next question comes from the line of Glenn Chapman from AFP. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, evening, or afternoon, everybody. Just hopefully some quick points of clarification. Can you say how much, specifically how much reduction in content review has been done by humans due to the COVID? We're referring to the increased reliance on automated systems. Can you sort of say it's cut in half, it's cut into a third? Can we have just a kind of a clarification on how much human reduction review has happened? And then I apologize if this was previously announced, but Monica, when were those changes to like you'll be deported if you show up to vote? When were those implemented? Is that sort of previously announced and or those new kind of those kinds of announcements? And then Monica, also, if you can give some more context on how you decide what kind of meme or implicit content it is. Like, for example, does the new ban on content, does it include like Holocaust deniers? Does that go into that section of Jews controlling the world? So there's some more sense of how you figure that one out. Thank you.
Hey, I'll jump in on that first question and then Monica can take the second and third parts. So on human review workforce, we don't have exact numbers to change. Largely, most reviewers are back online working from home. But the thing that we work through as we think about the system of content enforcement is not just how many people, but how effective they are in a slightly different environment, what kinds of content they're able to review given the different environment they're in, and how we need to balance what kind of work they do to ensure that we're taking care of their well-being and their families. And so it's a bit of a more nuanced question, but largely most of our reviewers are online. But we continue to work through just the details of how our enforcement works.
And I can take the other two maybe I'll take them in reverse order, actually, about the changes with the hate speech policy. Around memes around, for instance, Jewish people controlling the world or global institutions. That's the boundary, basically, of that policy change. Although I will say, even getting to that policy change, we engage with dozens of organizations and experts, and those relationships will definitely keep, you know, we'll keep those conversations going because we know that the trends around hate speech will continue to evolve and our policies will continue to evolve with it. In terms of the changes to the expansion of the voter suppression policy, those are recent, and we did announce them. I want to say it was late June, June 26th or so in Mark's announcement. So just to be clear, our voter suppression policies where we remove misinformation about how or when you can vote, those have been in place since before the 2018 midterms. But in response to our dialogue with our civil rights auditors and the broader civil rights community, we did extend the policy to cover more. And that now means that we will remove content that, tells people they're going to get arrested if they go to the polls or says, I'm going to bring a weapon to the polls or other people should bring weapons to the polls.
Your last question comes from the line of Mozabik Bidar from CBS. Please go ahead.
Hey, all. Thanks for the time. We're now about 80 days away from the election. I'm wondering if you have specific plans to ramp up resources within that department for content moderation as far as fake news is related to the election, vote by mail, and other issues. Do you have plans to ramp up resources for that department?
Hey there. Our response to the pandemic is, you know, has largely been a result of all these investments that we've made over the years. As we've prepared for the elections, we are absolutely committed and focused on working towards the U.S. 2020 election to make sure that we are protecting the integrity of those elections. There's many different kinds of risks, and we've worked over the past years to combat coordinated inauthentic behavior, misinformation, voter suppression, and we continue to work on those, as well as evaluate in this fast-changing environment. We are always sort of red teaming and working with partners to understand what are the new risks, what are the different kinds of things that may go wrong, and very much focused on ensuring that we're preparing for different scenarios that may occur, and building systems and building the teams to be able to handle those.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us on this call. As a reminder, there was no embargo and the call was on the record. Hope everyone enjoys the rest of their day. Thanks very much.
This concludes the Facebook press call. Thank you for joining. You may now disconnect your line.